Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.
It's the Tennis Show on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, Abigail Johnson, Anna Smith and Roz Sattar. And we've got a couple of glorious Wimbledon finals to look back on. Nice and quick ones this year.
Well, one was.
Simona Halep pretty much thrashed Serena Williams. And when we're looking at whether these two finals were surprising, looking back at our most recent show, I think we all called Serena to win this final, so we'd kind of be lying if if we said this one wasn't surprising at all. But at the end of the day, Halep wins 6-2, 6-2, played incredibly well. I think we can probably all agree. Should we have seen it coming, looking at Serena's similar route to the final last year and similar results against Angelique Kerber, another counterpuncher who was in the zone? Is this something we should potentially have predicted?
I think the problem was that this time around, Serena's draw been a bit trickier. She'd lost, she dropped a set to Juvan and got better as she went on. Whereas I think last year she had next to no competition. And by the time she got to the final, Kerber was her main, you know, was the best level that she was against. And it showed. Whereas she got progressively better, she could have had problems against. In fact, she did. Didn't she drop a set to Risk as well?
She did. She went to three sets. Yeah. And that was in the quarterfinals, wasn't
it? Yeah. So she'd been challenged more. But whatever Simona's sort of idea and execution plan was, she carried it out to perfection. Body serves into Serena that jammed her up. And I think the issue is she was able to start training at the beginning of Wimbledon and just lacked that match sharpness. And the sharpness that you seem to have, I mean, I'll defer to you as the player, but the sharpness that you have when it comes to executing big points, which she just seemed to be overreaching all the time.
Yeah, she just looked off balance the whole time. It kind of looked like she was, I don't know, there was almost something wrong with her, but it was just, I think it was just one of those matches where the kind of the stars aligned for Halep, and, you know, she couldn't have asked for it to come at a better time. But I don't think any of us saw what was happening. Standard, I got my prediction wrong again.
No. not feel, alone in that.
I was going to say, I actually feel better now that you guys got it wrong with me. But it was, yeah, it was honestly just, I didn't see it coming, but you kind of noticed in the first game that Serena was just, it just didn't look quite right. There was just something that was a little bit off, and then she just couldn't find it. And it was like, you kind of got deja vu from last year again, where she was kind of like gesticulating and she was like, what's going on?
Down.
Yeah, and trying to do that, but then trying to rile herself up a little bit, but just she couldn't get anything going.
When she let that visceral yell out, I thought, right, okay, you're now, you know, I don't think she got quite round to business bun, but she let that visceral roar out in that first game, the second set. I thought, okay, we're on for a match. And then she got broken. It was just like, well, maybe not.
It's interesting because I've watched Serena so many times over the years, and it's usually when she goes down that double break that you think, okay, she's going to get herself together. She's going to pull herself through on sheer willpower, even if nothing else. I didn't feel that this year, and I wonder if it's the Grand Slam final situation. Serena used to be near untouchable in these Grand Slam finals. She's now lost three on the trot, and honestly, it's incredible that she's got to these three finals on the back of having been pregnant, giving birth, coming back to tour, and doing this so close to that having happened. But I would be surprised if there isn't some mental struggles there for her. In the press conference afterwards, she was trying to deny tension and that kind of thing. I think it was quite soon after the match for her to kind of analyse that. A lot of her responses to questions on that day started with, I don't know. I don't think she was quite in the mind frame of mind to properly assess that. But, you know, if she wasn't tense, she was certainly at least very flustered by the manner in which Halep was playing, the ball she was getting back, and was not in the frame of mind to come up with a game plan that was going to combat that on the day.
The only time I've ever seen her that flummoxed, and Angie was slightly different because she was so aggressive, it just threw her completely. But it was when she played Angie in Australia, and shots that would be winners against anybody else. I mean, there was this amazing rally where I think Halep came back with a running cross court, you know, from the back of the court to the net and across the court for a winner. And it was just incredible. But against anybody else, that shot, that dropper into the corner would have been a winner for Serena, except against someone like Halep or indeed Kerber. And to me, it just felt like Australia 2016.
Well, she was so comfortable on the court all fortnight, I felt, Halep. At the beginning, it was a bit iffy from her, but with the wins over Victoria Azarenka, particularly Coco Gauff, coming through in straights, she seemed to be warming up and performing incredibly well. Now, Anna, I'm gonna come to you. Do you think if Serena had played any better, she would actually have had a shot in this match? Because that is by far the best performance Halep's ever given, given the stage, given the player she was against. She hit 3-on-4 steros the whole match. I mean, for some players, it's good to hit 3 in a set. You know, we're looking at a match in total. Do you think Serena would have had a legitimate shot at the win had she found another game plan?
Yeah, most definitely. I think you can never count out Serena, especially when she's on her game. I think she just played a horrendous match, to be honest. I don't think there was much she could have done. But if you look at it where Serena's playing her top level and Halep's playing her top level, I think Serena wins every time. But she was just so poor on Saturday, and it was honestly just a little bit confusing what was going on. But I think she genuinely didn't know what to do. She didn't have a plan B. It looked like she couldn't power her off the court this time, and it just looked like everything was a struggle, and it was interesting.
Just quickly before we move on to the men's final, how do you think this affects Serena going forwards? Do you think that it's going to make it more difficult for her to break through, or do you think this is going to give her the drive to actually get across that line and get to 24?
She's always had a problem when it's a big milestone one. 18, 22, the big milestone ones seem to be the biggest issue. If it's just like an interim stepping stone to one of those, she seems to be fine. And tragically, I mean, we were talking about it just before we came on air. Tragically, the US Open is like the worst place for her to do it, because, you know, if we think we put pressure on our players, the pressure on her in New York is immense, and it just, something always happens there. And we thought it would be lovely for her to get 24 in New York and then get 25 and actually get the record in Australia, which would make it doubly sweet. But honestly, I can't see it happening. She can't miss out tournaments. That much is clear. She's 37 and she needs the match practice. I think she'll be in better form when she goes into New York, but it's just always a disaster for her.
But I think she alluded to it after, I think in one of the press conferences after, she was saying that it was that kind of confidence in finals matches as well. She said that she obviously hadn't had that for a long time because she hadn't played so many tournaments. Mm-hmm. So I think that's going to be something that potentially has to change in her schedule. She's going to have to maybe play one or two tournaments in the lead up to the Slam. She can't just expect to turn up and waltz it like she has previously. Yeah. So I think it'll be interesting to see going into the US Open. I think she's probably going to play a couple of tournaments.
She's going to do Toronto and Cincinnati.
Yeah.
But there was talk of, she ought to do something like San Jose. It is a premier, but it's not. It's like Stuttgart. It's like a baby premier. And she would probably be the top seed. And, you know, it would be a useful one to have under her belt, but she won't do it. You know, I mean, we were saying do San Jose, win San Jose, drop one of the two premier mandatories. Maybe Cincy and do Toronto, and at least get two tournaments under your belt. But she needs that, really does.
Well, confidence was quite possibly an issue for Serena on Saturday. Looking at Sunday, we all got better predictions on Sunday, but only by the skin of our teeth. Novak Djokovic saving double championship point to defeat Roger Federer in the first 12-all tiebreak that we have seen. So that was dramatic. More on that later. For now, whenever I was asked about this match, I predicted Djokovic to win based on mentality. Could you have a scoreline that demonstrated that more? He won 3 tiebreaks. He didn't win a set that wasn't in his tiebreak. It was all about peaking at the big moments, I felt. Do you think Djokovic played the better match or not?
I think he did. I mean, it's tragic for Federer, because didn't he have 14 more points in total? But yeah, it's all about the big points. And those two tiebreaks, Federer played abysmally. And then, of course, when it went to a tiebreak in the fifth, you just thought, well, you know, unless you up your game, you're not going to get it. But I was saying it's hilarious, because everybody was like, oh, you know, we after Isner Anderson, it's like, we can never have this again. We must have tie breaks. And then for this, it's like, how dare we have a tie break? It's like, well, you can't have all the pretty things. You can't have it. You can't have it both ways. But we, you know, it was always inevitable that that a fifth set tie break in Wimbledon was going to affect one of the big matches, and it happened in the first time around.
There was quite a bit of a reaction to the final, because it was a massive one, and a lot of people saying it's unfair that that Federer should lose that match, because you looked at the stat sheet after, he led on every stat bar one, which is crazy to see. But at the end of the day, that's not what tennis is about, right? Tennis is about bringing your best in the key moments. It honestly doesn't really matter if you've been the higher quality player. And to be fair, I thought both men had their dips and rises throughout the match. I thought Federer was far from perfect. I thought Djokovic was giving him more openings than he usually would in a slam final. So, I mean, is there any merit in that, oh, it was unfair on Federer?
No, not in the slightest. That's sport. That's the beauty of it. You know, he can win 13 more points, whatever you said, and still lose the match. But if obviously if you don't win those big points, then that's too bad. But those match points he played was... I've never seen him hit such a passive approach on a forehand in my life.
I think you messaged me and was like, what?
Yeah, I was so surprised. I thought, you know, that, I thought this was it. Like, I thought he was going to, you know, hit a dominating forehand like he always does. And then, you know, he just sort of kind of tickles it down the line. And you're just like, oh, well, Djokovic is like the best passer in the world. You know, it's not going to cut it. And that was the first time I feel like you've almost kind of seen a little bit of frailty in Roger, because that was the first time he actually looked nervous. And I think maybe the occasion of actually beating Novak as well, which he hasn't obviously done in a slam for a while. So I thought that maybe got to him a little bit.
Do you think the consequences that we're going to look back on this era, Djokovic is going to overtake Federer, and for all of Roger's brilliance, he's not going to be remembered as the greatest of all time?
It's interesting, you know, because there are a lot of current ATP players who their immediate reaction after the match was Roger Federer is still the greatest. So there's obviously, no, honestly, I saw it across the board. He's very popular, and I think with this greatest of all time debate, first and foremost, I don't think it's ever going to be brought to a conclusion because it's very subjective. But also, I think there's more to this title of greatest than just titles won. I think it's about, you know, the style of play. It's about how they're perceived by both the public and by their fellows as well. And as far as the greatest of all time title goes, I think that's going to have a massive bearing. Djokovic obviously isn't as popular as Federer and Nadal. But as far as it goes with Federer and Djokovic and whether he'll have a better shot at Djokovic than this, like I said before, you know, Djokovic was giving him openings. He was quite passive on second serve returns at times. He made uncharacteristic unforced errors, which you just don't expect from Djokovic in a slam final and against someone like Federer. Is he going to make the same mistakes twice? And did Federer really miss a massive opportunity here?
I think he definitely did. I think there was a... I personally think he will overtake Federer. Mm-hmm. I think all three of them, Djokovic, Nadal and Federer, will all get to 20 and above. And I think that I think Djokovic will surpass them all. I think that there's just something about this particular matchup that seems to have more needle than any of the others. And, you know, Federer being beaten in his own wheelhouse, I don't know that he's going to get that many chances again. This was his best possible chance. I mean, maybe at the beginning of the season in Australia when neither have played that many warm-ups, or, you know, battle of attrition in the US Open, but no.
What I find interesting about this match, just to kind of wrap up, is that I don't think you can really say Federer choked, even though he served for it, even though he had the championship points, because, you know, Djokovic and Federer both had their ups and downs. But also, if you look back, I saw a really interesting video online comparing the championship point that Federer played against Murray, 2012, to the one he played against Djokovic, his second one this time, identical. Murray missed the pass and Djokovic made it. So it's just interesting to see. I think a lot more of it was about Djokovic than people give him credit for.
Anna, do you think Federer did choke?
A little bit, I think. Because I not just necessarily on the match points, I'm going more back to the break points that he had, which were numerous. And just looking back at what he did on those break points, I think I can at least count three where he just sliced a second serve backhand into the middle of the court.
Yeah, no, that was a big thing.
And that,
yeah,
that for me was a massive thing that kind of showed that he was a little bit more tentative than he normally would be, and the fact that, you know, he had been hitting over them at previous points, and then all of a sudden, as soon as he got to a break point, he just chiseled it into the middle of the court. And an aggressive free-flowing Federer wouldn't have done that. He'd have gone for it, you know, chip and charge, at least given him something. But that was just one thing that really stuck in my mind from that match.
No, that's a very fair comment, actually, throughout the match, especially the middle portion of the match. The amount of those returns that he was just chopping really short was giving Djokovic opportunity. But the reason that I said that he didn't necessarily choke was because I think Djokovic did offer up his fair share of opportunities as well. So there was kind of coming and going from both players, I thought.
And both men played their part in a fantastic final. Given this was the longest men's final we've seen at Wimbledon and all of the brilliance involved, was there a frustration for you as real lovers of tennis that it had to compete for viewers with the Cricket World Cup final featuring England and also the British Grand Prix?
A little bit. I mean, from a perspective in the media centre, we're kind of lucky because we've got screens with multiple elements. So, you know, I could keep an eye on the cricket, but the most annoying thing was we finished this final and everything is down to what's going on at Lords. And I mean, I'll be honest, we're coming in and out of press conferences and then the super over, and everybody's like Googling super over, and you could hear the cheers going up from along the media corridor. You know, if you're a lover of sport, that was a perfect weekend, and we are essentially lovers of sport, but it's a shame that, although I will say it didn't actually feel to me like the longest final. I remember the 2008 final and it felt like an epic. This didn't, and I wonder whether mentally, for me, the 12-12 tiebreak didn't quite make it feel as epic.
I think the second set and the fourth set were kind of won fairly comprehensively by Federer, because I felt that Djokovic, he's so good mentally that he kind of almost knows when it's safe to drop off a bit. It really didn't matter that Federer ran away with that second set because Djokovic peaked for the tiebreaks. And I think, therefore, that the 2008 final all the way through was closer, but this had its kind of periods where one player was dominating, I think.
Fine margins, a worthy final. But coming up, we're going to be looking back at the tournament as a whole, and not everyone was quite that brilliant.
This is Love Sport.
It's the tennis show here on Love Sport Radio with Johnny Burrow, Abigail Johnson, Anna Smith, and of course Roz Sattar. We've looked back on sensational finals at Wimbledon, but not every performance was superb. What were the shock exits that caught your eyes?
I think a lot of them came in the first round, really, because everyone in Djokovic's half of the draw seemed to be gone within the first. Like the real contenders that could potentially knock him off, they seemed to fall at the first couple of hurdles. I'm thinking Alexander Zverev, Stefanos Tsitsipas.
Kevin Anderson.
Yeah, Kevin Anderson as well went out early on, which it was a surprise in a way, I guess, because he's a big serve and volleyer defending finalist. So you expect those kinds of players to do well. But at the end of the day, I feel like there's more depth in both draws than sometimes the players are given credit for. I mean, you look at some of the players that lost early, e.g. Ashley Barty, top seed in the women's draw. She was up against Alison Risk, who'd won more grass court matches than any other WTA player. Zverev got a really savage opening draw. Tsitsipas was up against Thomas Fabiano, who was playing really, really high quality. So if you look deeper into the results that were classed as upsets and shocks, were they all that shocking, I guess, is the question?
No, I mean, I was thinking, you know, I was going through, we always do a scattered seeds article after the first two rounds. I was like, Kerb, no, well, maybe not. Assar, no. But no. And as I went through, it's just like none of them are really shocks per se. You know, Muguruza, well, okay, she's nursing an injury. Everybody seemed to have a reason, except, I mean, Zverev, never's going to get past the second week. Tsitsipas probably was the only one that I was really surprised, but as you say, Fabiano's on an amazing streak. And Tsitsipas looked like he'd just been gut punched when he came into press, all tearful and soulful. You felt really sorry for him, but, you know, it was a weird one.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because Tsitsipas is a player this year who's taken his losses very hard. There are some matches that will stand out as being good matches, some that will stand out as being shocking. What about matches that could potentially be significant for the future? Because let's look back to French Open 2011. Serena Williams lost first round. So it sounds random, but I'm getting to my point, honestly. Virginia Razzano beat her first round, and that was really the springboard for Serena becoming near invincible. Do you see any of the shock in apostrophes or whatever. No, quotation marks. I'm not on it tonight. Apostrophes, my word. Do you see any of those shock losses and think, okay, this player can actually take this particular loss and use it as the springboard for something really great?
I mean, Tsitsipas is the only one that I think might have that passion and drive to use it to propel himself forward. Zverev's a mess at the moment, and until he sorts out all his management issues, I don't think we should even expect anything of him till next year, because, you know, his mind is just not on it. On the women's side, Kerber is the only one that I think ought to do better. Ironically, maybe even Joe. After her quarterfinal loss, that might be a catalyst for her once she gets back onto the hard courts, especially after that press conference.
What about Naomi Osaka? She went out first round to Yulia Putintseva, who'd beaten her already that grass court season. Twice it was in straight sets. Osaka, a player that many compare to Serena, she's obviously already won multiple slams, was on a great streak of form coming into this year. That was a real rock bottom for her to go out in the first round of a slam. Do you think that she is in the position at the moment to really look at that, look at what she could have done better, and to look at her situation as a whole and really get herself back on track for the near future, looking at the hard court swing American, the US Open? Is that a possibility for her?
Yeah, I would say so. I think she will be in more comfortable surroundings. I think she'll feel at home a lot more, and I think that's quite important to her. She obviously said before that, you know, sort of the grass and in Europe, she doesn't quite feel as comfortable, or I can't remember the word she used, but it just doesn't feel like how she would want it to feel.
Yeah, her whole European thing just seems to be a big mental block for her. The clay, she's always come off injured. The grass is not a surface that she has learnt to love. She hasn't quite got to Simona Halep levels of acceptance yet. I mean, I've just got pulled up the article to see who went out where. I think the hard courts will probably be, if she's going to have a resurgence, that's where she needs to do it. And it's a surface that suits her better. She can play aggressively, and she's got some good tournaments to sort of get herself back into the swing. It's just mentally Europe is just bad for her. I mean, some of the other people, Sabalenka went out in the first round. Vekic had a terrible grass court season after losing in the Nottingham final. It just went horribly wrong for her.
She had some tough draws, though. She opened against Alison Risk, didn't she, yeah, at Wimbledon?
Yeah.
And was 4-1 up, I think, in that deciding set before
Risk
she
had
lost.
Risk had one foot out the door.
Mm.
So, who else? And then Kerber went out in the second round. And the men... the names that went out, maybe Stan Wawrinka is the only one that I think was possibly, you know, I kind of expected more from.
Mm. Yeah, but on grass though, really?
Well,
it's not really his thing,
true,
is it?
True, but I'm surprised it was so early. But Kyle Edmund, we were talking about, and you thought that was a particular disappointment.
I just had a feeling that he could have maybe gone a bit further, and obviously being two sets to love up, and then the injury or whatever was wrong with him.
Is Kyle Edmund always going to be a disappointment? He seems
we're
not here to pull punches. Let's be honest. Kyle Edmund
looks like a punch.
I'm swinging at this point. Kyle Edmund looks more like a Tim Henman than an Andy Murray. Change my mind.
And Tim Henman was that much of a disappointment that they named a hill after him.
And then he got it taken off him by Andy Murray. All I'm saying is it's not going
to
be.
It depends Edmund's... who you ask as to what the hill's called.
Yeah.
So a lot of people still say it's Edmund Hill.
Edmund has a lot of work to do. He really does. He tends to pull the ripcord if he feels a bit of a niggle and injury, which is probably sensible. Why play on and hurt? But it seems to happen at big moments. And it certainly happened at Roland Garros and then here. He's in danger of being overtaken as the British number one, potentially by Dan Evans of all people.
Evans had a great grass court season.
Well, exactly.
Though.
But you know, and if he then translates that same work ethic, which sounds very strange adding those two together, but if you translate that same kind of momentum into the hard court, he could definitely catch Norrie, who's been a bit disappointing in general this year, and become the British number one. And be rewarded for the hard work that he's put in. But we're talking about Kyle Edmund, who we thought was going to be a worthy British number one, and he seems to just have I don't know what's the matter with him at the moment. He's just fallen by the wayside.
But I feel like he did almost peak before people expected him to. He was into that Australian Open semi-final when people at the beginning of that tournament didn't really have high expectations for him. So I think maybe he kind of put himself a step ahead of the game. And then because he wasn't able to back that up the next season, people are suddenly like, oh, and because Murray's off the scene as well, there's so much more focus and spotlight on Edmund, and therefore there's that much more pressure. And I mean, yeah, he had a couple of good wins. Djokovic, he beat Murray, he got his first title. I thought he was making decent progress. It wasn't anything like really out there impressive, but I thought it was pretty steady. And I mean, there's no doubt he has the talent and the potential. I don't think it's disappointing. I think he's just having a rough little
patch.
Yeah,
I was going to say, is this his slumpy year that Joe had last year? And then this year, because they always say it's the third year that really counts. When you have that breakthrough, then that sophomore slump, then you make your third year. And she's really made a lot of her third year. So is next year the year of Edmund?
Well, I hope so. As a British tennis fan, I think we all probably do. But I think the most important thing is just trying to get healthy. If he can have an actual sustained period of training where he can get some work in. I think he said that in the press conference after that he wasn't almost in good enough shape to last that five sets. And I think that's a big thing for him. You know, his game is based on physicality. And if he's not in good enough shape, then he's going to get found out. So I think he needs to try and get a good preseason behind him this time, get rid of this niggly knee problem and potentially whatever else he had wrong.
And in terms of breakthrough stars at Wimbledon, it's of course hard to look beyond Coco Gauff. Did we witness the beginning of a career for a new tennis great?
I think we've already said that, yeah, we did. She obviously has the support network around her. She has the aggressive game, but she can throw variety in as well already at a young age. She has the mental composure to cope with being on the big stages. But at the same time, I think there were other good runs that were overshadowed as a result of so much attention being on Coco Gauff. I'm looking over at Karolina Mukova, who people would not have had any expectations for ahead of the event. She took out Karolina Pliskova, who I didn't really rate highly as a contender, but you know, she'd won Eastbourne. Big serve and volley game, good on grass. And Mukova played a great game of variety and skill to take her down and compose herself mentally at the back end. Pliskova served for that win, I think, a couple of times, and she was able to edge it out 13-11 at the back end of the set. So, I mean, there were other players, right, that were really kind of having a good run for the first time in that tournament.
Yeah, Risk was another one that
I was going to say her, so you stole it.
Go ahead.
No, please carry on.
No, Risk as well. I mean, it couldn't actually happen to a nicer player. You know, I remember watching her on clay against Joe, and like, clay is not her thing. I mean, I find clay difficult, but at least I can sort of make an attempt at slide, and like, Risk sort of patters away to hit the ball and then patters back. And I was just watching it thinking, yeah, girl, that's not going to do you any good at all.
She's a bit like Bambi on ice.
Exactly, but on grass, she's like a mountain goat. So not that I'm referring
famously
to
famously good at tennis, mountain goats.
They are. They can butt the ball and everything. She had a fantastic run. I agree with you to a certain extent that everybody seemed to go Gauff crazy. But on the flip side of the coin, it actually captured the imagination for those people that don't watch tennis as often as we do. Just seeing everybody on the hill that night just jumping up and down and cheering actually was a pretty emotional thing, because these people stayed just to watch this 15-year-old that they had no idea. Plus, a little bit of me does sort of rub my hands in glee that it all happened here and not at the US Open. And the USTA must be seething that she had a breakout moment here.
Well, obviously, that was quite a moment. Speaking of good moments, good matches, just quickly, what were some of the best matches? What stood out? What do we still remember after a long fortnight, after which we probably forget a lot? But I mean, me personally, I'm looking at the Nadal versus Kyrgios match. Sure as heck lived up to expectations. Anna, do you want
you
to talk more about that?
You guys are just taking all my answers today. That's literally the one I'd written down as well.
You were talking up Nadal Federer as well. You were pretty impressed by that one, no?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we were maybe thinking of matches that maybe went under the radar a little bit more. But, you know, definitely Kyrgios and Nadal stuck out. Not just for the tennis, but just the pure needle that was in the match as well. I don't think I've ever seen Nadal wagging his finger at the box after he's won a second round match of a slam. And you know, the way he kind of got the crowd involved as well was something you don't necessarily see him gesticulating towards the crowd. So that was interesting for me. And then I guess maybe, I know it's the final, but the way Halep played against Serena was just, it was phenomenal. I don't think she could have played any better in her wildest dreams. You know, but they even, you know, some are like the Serena against the Risk. I thought that was an amazing match, the level of tennis they both played and kind of like the drama. And that was the first time you saw Serena really kind of get through one of these really tough matches. And you thought this was going to be it. So there were quite a few, but yeah, you're right. Probably the Nadal-Kyrgios match really stood out for me.
Well, the Risk played an abundance of three set matches. So I think she played a part in quite a few good ones. I'm looking at her upset of Ashley Barty in the, would have been the fourth round, would it? And Barty, obviously the top seed, expected to do well on grass. And I don't think she played very badly. She tossed in more second serves than she'd like to. But Risk, so strategically good, but looking to come into the net and be aggressive as well. I thought she really contributed a lot to this tournament, unseeded though she may have been.
Stars left, right and centre. A glorious tournament to look back on. And of course, not just new players breaking through, but new rules as well. Coming up, we're going to have a look at that 12-12 tiebreak.
This is Love Sport.
It's the tennis show on Love Sport Radio. 12-12 tiebreaks. Yes or no?
Big fat no. I've been saying this. I've been saying this since October when it first was announced. I'm not really a fan of final set tiebreaks in general at Grand Slams, to be honest. I think that a lot of the time, one player is going to wear out physically or mentally before long, and obviously, there's the odd occasion where it doesn't, but this format has been in use, the no final set tiebreaks at Slams, has been in effect for so long, and it's not actually had much of an impact. So I didn't think they needed to bring it in. And if you look back at recent history as well, Federer lost, I think, 15-13 in the fifth to Anderson last year. Well, there's a result that wouldn't have happened if this 12-all tiebreak had been in place. What are your thoughts on the 12-all tiebreak? Do you hate it as much as I do?
It's difficult. I think as a fan, I would be all for playing advantage in the final set. As a member of the media, having lived through Isner Anderson, something had to change because it just makes for a very, very exhausting run into any kind of slam. You're just so tired because you can't do anything until that match is finished. It had a knock-on effect on the women's final that year. I can understand why they brought it in, and I can understand kind of why they say 12-12, but it now means that every slam has got something different. So I think for Australia, it's
a 10-point tiebreak.
Normally it's 6-6, yeah?
Yeah.
And then for France, it's to play to advantage.
Good old France. Let's all go over to Paris and give them some support.
But we'll see if they change that, if they're going to move to night sessions with the roof on Chatrier. Wimbledon, obviously 12-12, and then the Americans just play a normal tiebreak.
Don't you think that's a bad look for tennis, that the four most prestigious events are all playing with a different format? I mean, Anna, some people just rock up for Wimbledon, right? So they're going to be confused if every Grand Slam is played by a different format. It's not a good look for tennis, surely.
Not really. I think it does make it quite tricky for the fans to keep. I mean, to be fair, I didn't even really know the rules, not going to lie. So that's not great. That doesn't look good on me. It's a strange one. Either they need to all do the same thing, or I think something maybe needs to change. But what we're talking about, the 12-all, I think potentially in like from first round to semis, maybe play a tiebreak because then it doesn't mess up the schedule quite as much. But then maybe for the final, kind of just let them play advantage.
To clarify the rules of this new kind of tiebreak for anyone listening at home, the way it works is you play quite a bit of extra tennis and then Novak Djokovic wins. In terms of that final, did it change the result?
I think it did, and it's not something I would have thought I'd be saying at the beginning of the match, because I did always think that Djokovic would win this on the basis of he's mentally primed for these Grand Slam finals against Federer. And the most shocking thing in that final to me was that Federer actually broke to serve for it and had championship points on serve. Didn't see that happening. But you look at the tiebreaks that had already been played. So they played a tiebreak in the first set and in the third set. Djokovic didn't make a single unforced error. And I think across the three tiebreaks that were played in total, I think Federer made 11. And when he's already lost those two first tie breaks, that's in his head. If it goes to a tie break, you know, Djokovic has the clinical record in them in the match. And for Djokovic, I think you could, before he admitted to it slightly after the match, you could even see in the way that he was playing that he was pulling for a tie break, because it was, and we were saying this before, it was Federer that was getting closest to breaking to serve for it. Even, and I was, got to say, I was quite impressed with how Federer handled himself after losing the championship points and dropping serve, because at that point I thought he'd go, probably crumble. But he was very focused. He just kept playing his game. He kept going. And I did think he was coming the closest to break. I thought Djokovic, while he was mentally sound, looked the closest to crumbling physically. And I just think that if that tiebreak had not been in place, Federer might be on 21 Grand Slam titles now and Djokovic would be at 15, which is a more significant gap than currently is.
Yeah, definitely. I think, as I said it before, nobody like remembered that Nadal was so close to Federer until the Roland Garros final. And now it just seems to be within grasp, you know, far more for Federer, for Djokovic, and it'll be interesting to see just how aggressive he plays now in the US swing, because as I said, Federer in his wheelhouse, to lose at Wimbledon. Wimbledon to me is always Federer's best chance of adding to his slam total. Now, the hard courts, no, clay, sorry, no. So, you know, I don't know how many more chances he's going to get, and I think that was a chance gone for him because of the tiebreak.
One of the things I hated most about, because I've shared very much that I do hate this, the 12-all tiebreak when it was introduced, is that I kind of hate how much change is coming into the sport. I think to an extent there are some things that, that need altering, but there's so much progress with technology, etc. People are even talking about replacing lines judges with Hawkeye, that kind of thing. With something like this, we've just seen the first Grand Slam final that incorporates a 12-all tiebreak. This having happened, do you think it makes tennis more likely to keep evolving, as it were, and keep introducing new things? Or this type of scenario, do you think this is going to make the majors in particular more wary when it comes to kind of changing their rules?
I think we have to look to kind of keep with the times. You know, obviously we can't get stuck back in the dark ages in terms of, you know, not having Hawkeye and things like that. So I think tennis does have to keep evolving. I think Wimbledon will always have certain traditions that they're going to stick to. But I do think it's important for the sport to, you know, trying to keep doing things differently, trying to keep attracting new fans and things like that. So I think there are certain things that have to stay the same, but then there's certain things that still have to keep evolving as well.
Do you think the all whites at Wimbledon will ever go? It's a bit of a random thought that crossed my mind, but I'd hate to see that go. You know, it just makes it feel kind of more prestigious in a way.
Well, I was going to say the amount of board membership wranglings that had to go on for the Olympics was unbelievable, just so that people could play in their country's kit and change the livery around the court. It was actually mind-boggling, but I like it. There are certain traditions I think you shouldn't lose at Wimbledon, and that's one of them.
But we're seeing all kinds of sports make concessions on these things because it all comes down to money. Huddersfield Town announced their new kit today, which has a whole sash reading Paddy Power across the front. Are we going to get to a point? Well, that's one word for it. Are we going to get to a point, even at Wimbledon, where a massive corporation is going to come along and go, we'll give you 500 million billion pounds, but you all have to play in purple? Might that sway their thoughts?
Well, in Australia, we already have a court that's named after a gin brand, I think, 1572 or so. I don't know, it's like a postcode from one of the courts.
And oh,
it used to be Hisense.
There we go.
And that's what it was. So Hisense was obviously a big electrical firm, and it's now been overtaken by some gin firm, I think. and that's the name of the company. But I can't see Wimbledon doing it, but I do think that the more commercial slams, like the US Open and the Australian Open, will probably continue to name their courts after brands of alcohol and all the rest of it. But I can't see Wimbledon doing the Gordon's court. No. Court three or something.
No, I'd be gobsmacked if they did. Maybe they can make a PIMS court or something like that. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think the board members would...
They've only just allowed us to have Instagram. So they're not going to...
No, I can't see it. I can't see it happening. I think I think the amount of money that Wimbledon generates is you know, massive. I just can't see it changing. It would. For me, it would just lose that aura if it did.
Is Wimbledon the most traditional sporting competition in the world, bar none?
I think it's trying to retain its position as such. I think if you do go on and have further change, then, I mean, it kind of takes the tradition out of the traditional event if you're kind of changing stuff, doesn't it? So I think it will always have this perception. It's like Oxford and Cambridge Uni. Do you know what I mean? They kind of have this, they are the prestigious unis. So whatever goes on the inside, they have this kind of front that everyone expects Oxford and Cambridge to be these high profile, brilliant, you know, universities, you know, I can't really think of the right words, but you know what I mean?
Seat of learning.
Yeah, but they kind of have this image that I think Wimbledon has in the sporting world.
But it's interesting that you're comparing Wimbledon to two elite institutions, because is it accessible? If you keep all this tradition, is it not just a bit middle class?
Well, I mean, you're talking about making it accessible. I know people that will queue and run for the hill on the days where it's only ticketed show courts, and that, you know, and they know exactly where to run to. They know exactly where to get in. And it's still the only sort of the whole queue thing is just a unique element to it. But yeah, it's interesting because the players have this thing. Alison Riss did this fantastic piece for Wimbledon Television about reaching the last eight club, which is prestigious enough. And then Simona Halep was just fixated on getting that membership badge. And, you know, I don't think she even registered that she won the Venus Rosewater plate. It was more the little badge when she came in. It was just like, look
so
what
funny,
I've got.
Wasn't it?
And it's just like, oh, bless you.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's that prestigiousness or prestige that they actually want, you know, to be a part of.
Yeah, good point with the queue, though. I mean, there's nothing really middle class about sleeping in a tent in a field overnight, is there? So a good shout there because,
Have you ever queued?
No, I haven't actually. No.
We should do a Love Sport feature on...
No,
no chance of my queuing.
Anna will be playing.
I want to be back on court playing. There's going to be no queuing involved next year.
Well, coming up on the tennis show on Love Sport Radio, we're actually going to be talking about new halls of residence at Oxford and Cambridge, which are just tents lining up the road.
This is Love Sport.
Wimbledon was glorious, but guys, it's over, and we've got to look forward. There's quite a bit of tennis yet to be played, and it might not favour Roger Federer.
Might not after that final. The mental... I mean, Anna was saying in the last episode about the mental aspects of the game being 80% compared to the physical aspects, and therefore you've got to look at results at Wimbledon and look at how it might affect each player mentally, because I think the biggest separation between players at the top of the rankings and players even ranked outside the top 200 is mental, right? Some of them, they hit the same way, they can do the same things on court, but if you're not in the right headspace, it's not going to happen for you. So looking at Wimbledon that's just gone, who's going to be in a good headspace going into the American hard court swing? And like we were saying before, it might be some players who didn't perform well at Wimbledon but are now going onto a surface they're more comfortable on, right?
I'd put Konta in that mix.
Osaka, for sure. I think she has to be comfortable with her surroundings again, being kind of back home in the States. I think you've got to look at, like, Roger as well. I think he still enjoys playing on the hard courts. I think he always has his chance at the US Open. I think he'll still be happy that he made final. I know he probably won't be happy that he lost, but the fact that he still beat Rafa and still kind of knows that he can get so close to Novak, I think that's got to be a good thing for him as well.
To add in about Roger, after he lost that final to Djokovic, obviously I think that makes it more difficult when he comes up against Djokovic at back end of majors. But while the US Open is a more open Grand Slam in that, you know, a lot of, like Stan Wawrinka's won it in recent years, Marin Cilic, it's the more opportune slam, I feel, for some of the outsiders. I feel that if Federer didn't come up against Djokovic, he is a very strong, if not the strongest contender, because from his post-match reaction, and maybe shock hadn't truly set in, I thought he was handling the loss so much better than he did, for example, in 2014 when he didn't have championship points, but he was in tears at one point after that loss to Djokovic. Whereas this time he almost kind of seemed to shrug it off and said, oh, kind of was able to joke about it, I hope I forget this kind of thing. So maybe he will find it easier to bounce back from this mentally than he would have done 3-4 years ago.
I I don't know. I was going to say, oh, you know, maybe parenthood puts it in perspective, but they've both been parents for quite some time now, so I don't even think it's that. I don't know with Roger whether it's because he's still achieving at this age means that he still feels that he's got a shot. And also with none of the young guys actually really still to prove themselves, why not? I mean, that's the thing that stands out is that all the young guns, we lost Team as well in the first round. So Team, Zverev, Tsitsipas are the ones that everybody thinks are going to be taking over, and forget about Generation Lost Boys because I think they're done now. So, you know, there's nobody's overtaken them at all. Whereas on the women's side, we've run out of fingers and toes collectively if we try to look at some of the people coming up. So I don't know. I still don't see Federer winning on hard courts again.
Full stop.
Oh. Okay. I don't see him winning. I always think that Wimbledon is his best shot, and that's the one that you can never write him off for. I can't see him on hard courts because this is the place that I expect the youngsters to actually make some difference.
You're shaking your head. Tell us why.
I think this is because, like, this is what I'm thinking about my predictions, and I'm thinking I should go for Novak here, so maybe I should do the complete opposite. So this is where I go for Roger. I just think the courts are a little bit quicker at the US Open, which suits Roger's game. I think he enjoys the fast courts, and I don't know if maybe the slow courts at Wimbledon didn't quite suit him as much this year. You know, he maybe struggled a little bit compared to last year, so I think the speed of the course could help. So I still wouldn't count him out. And like you were saying, the younger guys, they're not really coming up and kind of testing them. And I think once you reach the last slam of the year, a lot of the time it comes down to who's fittest and who actually isn't injured.
100%.
And I think if Roger has a smart schedule, which he undoubtedly will leading into the US Open, then he's always going to be one of the favourites. I just don't see anyone else being able to come through. You look at Zverev, probably going to lose first round again.
Well, I think I remember when Abigail knows that we used to have a prediction game on BritWatch Sports where I think...
Can I just say, I'm never doing that.
Ever. Oh, no, you totally
that's not,
are.
That's not going to happen ever.
But one of my colleagues that actually predicted as a shocker, Pliskova making the second week of a slam. This is supposed to be a shock exit. I was like, you can't have that. He's like, but it would be. Just like Zverev actually making it, you know, not to the first Monday or the second Monday, but actually going beyond the second Monday to something with a quarter or a semi written in it. But, you know, I don't know. I just think the US Open will be survival of the fittest. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to be Federer.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you raised that point about New York being about who's fully fit, because we've seen Kei Nishikori made a run there in 2014. He's injured all the time, but he wasn't injured at the time when a lot of players had so much action during the year that they were probably waning a bit. So given that it's more of an open event, who's kind of an outsider that you would expect to be able to get a bit of a good run? And I know that's very much putting you on the spot here, because like we say, there's a vast pool of talent. But bearing in mind it's a faster surface, is that going to favour the power players? Because we saw a lot of counterpunchers actually thriving on the slower grass courts at Wimbledon. So is it time for players like on the women's side? I mean, let's look at Petra Kvitova and Amanda Anisimova, players that are hitting really clean and lethal.
If Kvitova can get over her asthma and just issues that she has at New York, then I don't see why not. I mean, her loss to Joe was a surprise. She pulled out of press, which was very, very rare for her. You know, that loss affected her a lot. She should do well in the States. She never does because it plays havoc with her asthma. Maybe some of the youngsters, Kenin, Anisimova, Vondrousova maybe? I don't know. I'd like to see Kazakhina suddenly make her resurgence out of nowhere. But they're just players that don't have that level of consistency. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Who would you see getting a big upset? Because Roger Federer went out to John Millman last year, which isn't something...
Who?
That, I mean, John Millman is a very good player, actually. And it was part of, actually, his match with Sam Querrey at Wimbledon.
I need to stop criticising tennis players around you lot. It's a really dangerous game.
No, Millman versus Querrey.
Yeah.
Wimbledon, I feel like Abigail's like his biggest fan.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just don't... Yeah,
he's the mailman. Norman the mailman. He always delivers.
Yeah, he didn't in the match against Querrey fully, but I mean, it was very close. Lots of serve and volleys and that, but like, it was a shock. No one really expected Federer to go out to Millman, so yeah, Johnny, it was a shock. But I mean, who's most likely to kind of suffer the shock loss then? Because Nadal would often be a pick, but he's transferred his form really well across all three surfaces lately. He's been right up at the top.
Yeah, I would have said Nadal is always one to take. Oh, gosh, who knows? I don't know.
Del Potro, Wawrinka could have good runs as well, I think. Yeah. I think their games would
suit. Is Del
Potro
going to be back there by then?
I hope so.
He's gone deep at the US. Last 2 years, he went final last year and semis the year before, right?
Yes, he did.
So
yeah.
He consistently going.
But I'm not sure that he's going to be back from that patella injury again quite so quickly.
It goes back to the injuries and physical things, doesn't it? And who's actually going to be there to give it a
Dan
go?
Dan Evans is going to win everything.
You heard it here first. Guys, we've got glorious tennis still to look forward to, but it's coming up to time, and it's coming to the end of our last tennis show here on Love Sport Radio. It's been absolutely wonderful, a wonderful summer in all of your company. Just quickly, what were your highlights? One word, one player, who impressed?
Nadal, just his sheer consistency is amazing at the moment.
Dan Evans for me, I think. I think his resurgence was amazing, and I'm looking forward to seeing what he can do for the rest of the year.
Halep all day long.
Halep all day long. Well, Abigail Johnson, Anna Smith and Roz Sattar, thank you for a wonderful summer of tennis, a wonderful summer of broadcasting, and we'll see you very, very soon right here on Love Sport Radio.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.